All right, everybody. You know how in, like, I think episode 2 or 3, we said there was going to be a quiz at the end of this? Well, now's time. Get ready. Pull out your pencils. Number 2's only. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Messed Up Midnight Podcast, the show that's here to give you advice when you don't ask for it. I'm your host for this episode, Michael Flaherty, and as always, I'm joined by the man who called amputees 75% downloaded. It's Max Steele. Max, how you doing, buddy?
What the? That has nothing to do with what we're doing today, but what the fuck?
I shot for the moon, buddy. Come on, I'm bringing it all in.
I mean, we're not talking about 127 hours, so like
James Franco is nowhere to be found.
Probably for the best in this episode. Probably for the best. Let's be real here.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Oh, my Lord.
Well, Mike, man, I'm excited to be here because we're trying something new this time. We're experimenting with some ideas. Mm-hmm. We're going to test out some different things. We said it last week, and we're going to see what works. And this first episode of this untitled thing that we're doing, it actually stems from a question that your dad, the great Martin Flaherty, mm-hmm. asked us.
Yes. The man himself really cornered me one day, and he just turned and just went, "So you've watched a lot of garbage, right?" And I was like, yeah, it's comes with the territory on this. And he goes, "What the heck have you even learned from watching all this garbage?" He's like, and you know what? I stopped and I kind of went, Max and I always make jokes on we're getting crash courses and master classes and everything that you're not supposed to do. And we're learning, we're going through film school in like the worst, most like deep fried way possible. But I mean, I feel like we as we sort of like talk to each other, Max and I, we both kind of agreed that we actually had some decent insights that we were kind of like, yeah, you know what? This actually isn't stupid. Like, granted, a lot of this is hot shit coming from two people in their 20s who watch garbage for fun. But I mean, you know what? It's still something. Don't you agree, Max?
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, dude, you got to think about it. We've watched over 100 bad movies on 100 movies on this show. You know, some good, most of them were very bad. And we've also seen a lot of bad movies on our own time. For instance, I most recently watched Winnie the Pooh, Blood and Honey, the first one. So I really feel that just like watching, especially like me taking it from the perspective of a wannabe filmmaker, I see these bad movies, and there are some great lessons to be learned when it comes to filmmaking, when you watch how not to do something. And I really think that can be attested to with my experience when I was in school. So when I was in college, I got a degree in mass media. It was like all media, but like I mainly focused on the filmmaking side of things. And, you know, the classes that I took about film, we're primarily talking about, you know, the good movies and what makes a good movie. Like we talk about, you know, The Godfather, 2001 A Space Odyssey, Citizen Kane, Un Chien en la Deux, that old French film with the eye getting cut out and there's like a picture of a cloud going across the moon. It's really fucking weird, but like I remember like every single like old film textbook talked about this film. But I can't ever recall us talking about a bad film. They don't use those examples. They don't talk about what not to do. And after doing this podcast, I think it's important because as a filmmaker, we're always shown what you have to do. But we also need to see what doesn't work and then also talk about why it doesn't work and then apply that to your own work. Trying to copy the greats can only get you so far because just to be honest, you're not Quentin Tarantino. You're not Martin Scorsese. Like you're you, and that's fine. But you can watch these bad movies and take lessons and be like, okay, so I shouldn't do this, but instead take my own twist on it, and then that'll work. Mike, what are your thoughts on
that? I completely agree on this. I think this is a great observation. It's, You can see Kill Bill 100 times over and learn every single shot that Quentin Tarantino did. You can learn how he took the blood spurting out of people's arms and heads from Akira Kurosawa movies, how the black and white was taken from Seven Samurai, and like the comic books were inspired by stuff like Akira and the and Ghost in the Shell and the likes. But that's not, but the most that's going to tell you is, okay, so hearkening to certain directors is a really good idea. Paying homage is always nice. And you can learn some scene setting up stuff. But at the end of the day, that's just what Quentin Tarantino did in his movie that worked. It's not necessarily going to be what you do in your little thing that works. Whereas, if you watch, let's say, Gotti, you see sloppy cuts, terribly set up shots. You have ham-fisted dialogue, writing, actors who don't care, don't want to be there, nothing that works. You learn everything that falls flat, and you can go, okay, with my movie, I was originally thinking of having a shot set up like that, and then go, that sure shit didn't work. I probably should do that. And just moving in the other direction. It's giving you, I feel like in a certain way, it's actually helping you out more in a very weird, twisted way. It's helping you out more because instead of going, yeah, just mimic what this dude did, it's going, I don't know what you're going to do, but don't do what he did. Like, it's like looking at a car crash on the side of the road. You're like, all right, shouldn't do that.
And as a guy that has seen a wide variety of student films, I've seen some great, amazing ones. I've also seen some that are not of the best quality. So you oftentimes see people try to like do the homage thing with it, and it just kind of not working because, again, it's one of those, you don't have the budget, you don't have the resources to do this stuff that you're trying to like pay homage to, like a Quentin Tarantino or a Akira Kurosawa. You don't have that. But what you do have is your own voice and your own like ideas, and taking those ideas and then implementing them into, you know, trying to see where they fit. And then you compare it to a bad movie. You're like, okay, don't do that, but let me try this. And then might work, might not. But Mike, I think the best place to start when discussing the bad movies is where all movies start, on the page. Let's talk about the script.
Oh my God. I have some things I want to say about this script writing. Okay, I'm going to go with my sort of top one. Have faith in your goddamn audience. Too many times I hear, or I feel like with a lot of these movies, I get spoon-fed every information that the director or writer is afraid I may have missed. And I really want all the prospective directors and writers out there go, okay, are there going to be a few complete morons in your audience? Yeah. Is the grand majority of the people in your audience going to be complete morons? No, they're going to be functioning human beings. You could probably put a decent bit of faith that they're going to string together stuff. And you know what? If not, congrats, you made Primer. Like, that's what I can say, all right? It's not necessarily a horrible thing. Not necessarily a good thing either. But I, you know what? It's just believe in us a little bit.
Yeah, like, you do need to have faith in your audience, and, you know, be able to like spoon feed them some information, you know, but don't make it just so like so subtle that like it completely misses, like, oh, did you see that look that they did there? That means they know something. Like, and like 95% of the audience is like, I have no, you didn't even show that look or anything. So
exactly.
But you do need to have faith. You need to be able to like set things up and then pay them off. But Mike, that's a very good first point.
Yeah. And I think that the key Hallmark movie I can consider with with a request like this, with the lessons learned like this, is the movie Blade from 1999 or something like that with Wesley Snipes. Do I love Blade? Yes. I think Blade is hilarious. I think Blade's great. I think it's campy and fun. I love Blade. Blade shoves exposition down your throat. Mm-hmm. Like, it lives and breathes by exposition. And it's miserable in between its goofy action sequences. Like, I mean,
I was going to say, the same thing can also be said for I, Frankenstein. If you remember when we covered that one, like, that movie just was like, these are gargoyles. These are angels. They're feuding because of X, Y, and Z. And it's not doing it. And like, you need to have a little bit of that. But then like, when it goes overboard with the exposition, and I think that's a real problem that like a lot of like sci-fi and fantasy films have, is setting up your world and just like, you have to do a little bit of explaining, but you don't want to do too much. It's a fine line that you got to be walking with that one.
Exactly. Exactly. You have to walk a fine line, as my co-host said. But I definitely do think that you're better off being more subtle than being more obvious. I think that more often than not, the more obvious, like, exposition dumping is I feel like it's more heinous and I get more offended. Like, I'd rather be sidelined than be, like, spoon-fed the result.
Mm-hmm. And you can also do a little bit of, like, drip feeding where you answer a question, but then that also presents more questions. And you see that a lot, like, with some really good thrillers, like Memento, for instance. You're introduced, there's setup and then there's payoff. But then, like, with the payoff, that also presents a different question. And it's just this, like, constant cycle throughout the end of the movie. Now, with the script, the big rule, I'm speaking broadly about the like most movies out there. If I don't care about my characters or believe in their goals, your movie is going to have a long uphill battle.
Absolutely.
And, you know, horror movies can kind of skate by like, you know, having some great kills. But they do have to be great kills and have great tension. You know, action and sci-fi, they can be enjoyed for their visuals. But again, they have to be really great, phenomenal visuals. And even then, you're still going to be, you know, bored, like, between the, you know, action set pieces. And having believable, like, or having characters where you believe in their goals, having characters that you care about, takes that next step from your film just being like a forgettable whatever movie to being like an actually good film. Mike, what are your thoughts on that?
Oh yeah, I'm right there with you. I'm right there with you. It's you, I think, starting off with your characters and seeing if you can properly flesh them out in a way in which you care about your characters, or if you take them to a completely unbiased third party, and it's got to be unbiased. It can't be your significant other or your best friend who just tells you, yes, go for it. You got to bring it to someone who will tell you it's stupid. But showing someone else your fleshed out character, showing the hopes and dreams and the wants of the character, fleshing them out completely and making someone give a shit is the make or break. Because I feel like one of the things that really makes certain movies like No Country for Old Men succeed so well is its character, Llewellyn Moss. You want him to win. You want him to win so badly. His character is fully fleshed out from start to finish. You know his motivations. You know why he's doing what he's doing. You know, like, his beats and patterns, how he thinks, where his morals lie. It's fantastic. And that's just really, really speaks to it and speaks to the ease at which you'll be able to write your story if you can start with your characters.
And have their, like, motivations, like, just plain as day. Like, this person wants to keep the secret. This person wants to marry her. And then we have characters. in the After franchise.
Hell yeah. Just
flip, like they're like a fucking pancake. They just keep flip-flopping on what they want. And, you know, like Harden wants to be with Tessa, but then Tessa doesn't want to be with Harden. And then Harden's it's just like that constant flip-flopping. When you have it in a movie, that's one thing. But then when you have it the same shit in a franchise, that's another thing. No, I still haven't gotten over the fact that we've watched every single fucking After movie.
It's a torture room of your own design. It's you created the problem and then you experienced the problem. And now you're like, problem bad. You know what, buddy? I'm glad you joined this side of the aisle. Finally, we were all waiting for you. No, but fair enough. I absolutely agree with you on that. Having a character who like flip-flops with their morals is totally fine. Having a franchise of characters, plural, heinous, bad, no bueno, don't like.
And another issue that I think a lot of these bad movies have is pacing. And that can, you know, comes down to the writing, but that also comes down to the video editing, which, you know, it's kind of like a 1A, 1B thing with that. So is the scene too long or too short? Am I bored? Is it hard to follow? It's very tricky striking a balance between the two things. Like, for instance, let's say we have a 10-minute scene of two characters talking. It can either be like gripping cinematics with twists and turns with new information and then new reveals, or boring as hell, the same unfunny joke being told over and over again. And, you know, ultimately it comes down to like, is there a conflict, either internal or external, with this scene? And in a movie that we've covered, I think to Reptilicus, when the movie goes from being this big monster movie to just all of a sudden a tourism ad for what, Denmark?
Denmark, yeah.
And we're just like, wait, what? I thought this was, you know, crap, you know, movie, like monster movie effects aside, that still fucking grinded the whole thing to a halt. And we're like, okay, why is there, whatever, sure, Denmark's great, fuck it, yeah.
Exactly. No, it's like driving, it's like riding in a car down a road. You want the car to slowly pick up speed and then eventually like start to gradually brake until you're at a full stop. You don't want the car to slam on the gas, slam on the brake, slam on the gas, slam on the brake, slam on the gas, slam on the brake. You're going to be nauseous by the end of it. It's not going to be a fun ride. Same thing with the movie. You have to have that slow, gradual pickup. And I'm going to pull out, I'm going to pull out Memento on this one, mm-hmm. that I think is a pretty good example of this. It starts off really, really slow because you're kind of just sort of trying to pick up the pieces alongside this guy. And as things slowly, as the puzzle essentially starts to fall into place, things pick up and get faster and faster and faster until the big conclusion. And when you put in the final piece, and then it just sort of, and then you just sort of get the full picture and you're like, oh my God. And then the movie ends. That is great. That's a great sort of example of how this is supposed to be done.
And the same thing can be said with, you know, relaying information about the world. Whereas like, you know, a movie like Ice Pirates or Zardoz is just like that meme where it's like, no time to explain, get in. Like we gotta go. Like we're like, you know, it's like Mike said, like where Memento was putting the puzzles, you know, together so they all fit nicely together. Zardoz and Ice Pirates is like you taking the box of the puzzle and just fucking throwing the whole thing on somebody else and be like, did you get that? And they're like, fuck no. It's like, no time, let's go. We got another puzzle we gotta do.
That's nightmare puzzle piece putting together. Just as someone toss it to you. It's like that old 52 card pickup game trick that people would say in like elementary school. Oh my God. I'm gonna move to a different section of the written page here. Back towards the writing your characters and such like that. I'm gonna say the next little thing I've got is chemistry is everything. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, this is equal, I would say this is equal parts an actor issue as well as a writing issue. Mm-hmm. I would say that being able to have your main character and the main side character or the main antagonist have chemistry of some kind is huge. And in a lot of ways, that is a little on the intangible side, which is true. That's tough. I can't really narrow down the specific do's and don'ts of don't write this down, do write this down, because I haven't written a freaking story. But mm-hmm. pointing out places where chemistry does not work is no more apparent than romance movies. Max, you mentioned After. I'm going to toss Geely into the ring. Geely was a hot garbage field mess mm-hmm. with no chemistry between two people who were in a relationship. Like, mm-hmm. it doesn't get more tee up for chemistry than that. It's equal parts.
I'll even throw in, basically all the romantic movies we've covered, Glitter. Mm-hmm. But the main one I said when you said, the main one I thought of when you said chemistry is Four Christmases.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. That's a clear one. That's a clear one.
And that's also like not just because of, you know, the acting on screen, but like also with what we talked about with everything behind the scenes with Vince Vaughn and what was it? Reese Witherspoon. Yes, that one. And they just had absolutely zero chemistry, like behind the scenes. They just butted heads a lot. And that happens sometimes. And sometimes we get really great performances with that on screen. Other times we don't. But yes, I completely agree with you. And looking at where chemistry is important, where we can see it done well, is super bad. Seeing Jonah Hill, Michael Cera, and then Christopher Mintz-Plasse.
Yeah.
Seeing them all act together, even though Jonah Hill hated McLovin behind the scenes, they were still able to make it work when it came to the cameras rolling. And, you know, that's just, again, a great example of picking out, like, writing the good shit and then picking out the actors to perform the good shit.
Exactly, exactly. And, again, the actors themselves, their relationship with the other person, it's a big part of it, mm-hmm. but it's not the be-all, end-all. There are thousands of examples, much like Superbad. I know, in Titanic, Kate Winslet and DiCaprio, they were not the chummiest of people. They weren't exactly best buds. I don't think they were at each other's throats, but they were also, like, they were super close. And granted, their on-screen performance and their on-screen chemistry is just undeniable. And again, that just shows you that chemistry isn't exactly something that you can just go, well, they like each other. There you go. Mm-hmm. The chemistry can be absolutely whack. Mm-hmm. People get along. So,
and I think that does come down to like, are the actors cast well? And that's also a big thing, like with your film, because let's just be real here. Would you cast Jim Parsons as the next Jason Voorhees? No, you wouldn't. That's bad casting. Like,
it's hilarious, but bad.
Watch this episode is going to come out, and then like there's going to be a news article being like Sheldon from The Big Bang Theory is going to be the next Jason Voorhees.
That'd be cool.
I'll be like, well, shit. Well, fuck me then. I guess
it's the next. They're like the next Leatherface will be played by Christopher Mintz-Plasse, and you're like son of a bitch, McLovin.
It's like, you know, and let's be real here. Like, I don't even really fault the actors for being cast bad unless we get like, you know, a behind the scenes story about them demanding this one role. It's like usually I like to think 9 times out of 10, it's just actors are doing the best with what they got, especially if it's like their first role. Like, for instance, if someone came to me and asked me like, hey, we want you to play a good old country frat boy in what I thought was going to be like my big break in Hollywood, yeah, fuck it, I'm going for it. Or casting Mike in that role. Like, we hear that, we're like, sure, we're going for it. Are we gonna suck at it? Probably, but we're going to do it anyways.
Yeah, exactly. It is a huge part on the production team to be able to pick out an actor that actually fits the role. And you know what? That's an easier freaking project said than done. You know what? Getting a casting director to like pick out the person, or sitting with the author of whatever book you're adapting or screenplay you're adapting, is they're not even necessarily going to get it right. It's a tough freaking job. Like, I have a hard time believing like when they were casting like Zendaya and Timothy Chalamet and Rebecca Ferguson for Dune, that they instantaneously went, yes, absolutely, there we go, that's him. Like, granted, there's the David Lynch version, which you can argue is a basis, but I would kind of push that to the side. Truth be told, it's a very difficult job to nail chemistry, but it is a thing that is ultimately, I would argue, one of the biggest parts of the writing sphere of your movie.
And we should probably also say that neither of us are acting coaches. We are just talking about what we have seen when it comes to just the end product. So just keep that in mind. Yeah. But Mike, I would actually like to move on to a bit more of like the technical aspects. Like, the writing's great, but you know, we need like the cameras, the lights, the audio. We need all of that in order to make the film. And I want to start with looking at the visuals, like, you know, the cinematography. They matter, but not in the way that you think. You see, filmmakers, we want big, expensive cameras. And, you know, it's not really about the camera that you have. It's, you know, it's how you execute your vision with it. You know, can I see what's going on? Do we have relentlessly shaky cam like in Taken 2? Or do we have these long wide shots mixed in with some dynamic close-ups like in The Raid? Like, what do you, Mike, what do you think about that?
You know what? I completely agree. I know you know a lot about, you know, it's not the size of the camera, but it's how you use the camera. I know you know a lot about
that. You know,
that,
I had that joke written down and I was like, you know, I'm not going to make that joke because I know Mike's had a bit of a tough time of it recently. But now all bets are off.
All bets are off.
And Mike,
fucking,
it's okay.
Come
buddy.
At me.
It's okay, man. I just want to let you know
I'm out. I'm out for blood.
I know you are working with a 16 millimeter down there.
16 millimeter? That's so specific.
Like the camera. It's
an 8 millimeter. Thank you.
You see, some of us are rocking the 70 millimeter now, but
I'm rocking the red 4K camera. No. All right.
Guys, if your dick was a camera, what would it be? Let us know at the Messed Up at Midnight podcast.
Keep that shit to yourself. We don't want to know. All right. So, okay. I completely agree. Too many times, I feel like there is the complaints of like, oh, if only the budget was bigger or something like that. And, you know, while I do understand that for certain like fandoms, like, again, this is, I saw it not too long ago, so it's on the top of my mind, but like Dune was long considered to be unfilmable because of how expensive it would have to be, how big it would have to be. And lo and behold, it got done. But I would say whatever you're thinking of making is not Dune. You can probably work with something that you've got in your freaking garage. I mean, if you can drop the cash on a better one, it can't hurt. But it's definitely, you can work with what you have. It's so many times I feel like there's two, and this isn't even for filmmaking. This is for everything. But it's the idea of, well, I can't do it because I don't have the right stuff to do it. You're like, just fucking do it. Just shut up and do it. Like, just shut the fuck up and do it. That's the energy I get with this. There are some fantastic movies. Like, we mentioned it earlier on, but like Primer was made for literally $5,000. It's a feature length film that they filmed half of it in a public storage unit. Like, it's a magnificent movie. It's a genius movie.
Now, having great cameras can obviously give you a lot of great production value, but you can make do with what we have because, like, you can look at, you can like frame a shot and ask, is this shot interesting? Is it like a beige, grainy, non-contrasty, dimly lit, but not for the effect room with absolutely zero color or interest? Or is it the close up, or is it a close up of a woman, you know, with a foreground and a background and maybe like a splash of dynamic color? Now, to be clear, low saturation or dimly lit does not mean like bad, uninteresting, or boring. It's just the way that it's used. Is the shot supposed to be dimly lit? Like, is it night outside? Or did the crew not light the scene correctly at all? So I think, because I've seen some films where like, oh, well, where some student films where they're like, oh, well, it was supposed to be filmed like that. And I just want to look and be like, it is like bright and sunny outside, and I cannot see the person's face that you are showing. That mm-hmm. that's like an internal logic thing with my brain that makes me remember, oh, I'm watching a movie right now. So
yeah, exactly.
Just my two cents.
No, I 100% agree with you. I think that those shots and understanding like how they're supposed to be done and like those gaps, they're huge, and they can take the viewer out of the experience. Or and on the flip side, if you nail it on the head with those shots, that color like dichotomy, that perfect setup of having your character in the foreground and the big dynamic lighting in the background, you can make a shot that is like wallpaper, frame it and put it on the wall worthy. Like like in Wong Kar-wai's Fallen Angels is a prime example of that. Like the cinematography is magical. Granted, that's a high saturation example. I don't really have a low saturation example on the top of my head, so we'll work with it. But there are so many examples in this movie of having that sort of contrast, foreground, main character, almost working as a complete juxtaposition of this high saturation neon background to sort of not only sort of evoke a certain emotion, but also just to put this oppressive loneliness aspect on it. Like, it's adding in extra emotions to the shot, which I think is a really cool aspect of cinematography that I think people don't really understand, is how you can create ulterior emotions, like these big power dynamics between one character and another.
And I mean, we want to talk about bad cinematography on this podcast. The Curse of Bigfoot.
Oh my God. Just
that movie as a whole. Because that's exactly what I was talking about with it being bright outside, but it's dark and we can't see like any of the characters. Mm-hmm. So I just had to mention that. But I also wanted to say that just because you have a cool shot, you know, what's the point of it? What does this specific shot say about the stories, the characters, the relationships? I recently got done working on my own short film, and there were some shots and stuff that I was like, hey, this looks really cool, but we got to cut it. And that, you know, I was like, I don't really want to. It sucks. It's a good shot, but, you know, we got to do what we got to do for the sake of the story. Like, for instance, a close up between two characters of their eyes. You're like, okay, what does that say? Are they hiding something? Or is it done just because it looks cool? So, I don't know, Mike, was there anything else you wanted to talk about with the visuals? Because I have a little bit more on the audio side.
Oh, I'm so excited about the audio side. I'm so excited. Let's go. Let's do it.
So, audio, in my opinion, is the most underappreciated aspect of the filmmaking project. And by the way, I'm not just talking about the music, though great music can make your film phenomenal. It, you know, can drive your film to something a little bit better, something with more tension and all that. Just watch Darkroom or listen to our episode on Darkroom, and then you'll understand what happens when you don't take audio seriously, and you'll see how bad it can make your movie.
Oh, 100%, 100%. Audio, I like to feel, is the janitor that comes through your office / fast food eating establishment and, like, cleans up your mess. because we all have been in messes, or we've seen hoarders where people just don't throw crap out. People don't have a janitor to come in and help clean, or people don't clean up their damn selves. It gets out of hand, and it really becomes a glaring problem that, like, is inescapable. Darkroom is like a hoarder's example. If you ignore audio until the end and then go, oh, fuck, I guess we could just ADR. Yeah, we'll just bring them in, have them ADR. We're good to go. You are going to run into a giant problem. And
then, like, do a bad job of ADR. I want to make that. Yeah. I know that ADR is a usual process, but, like, if you're just like, we'll just all get together one weekend, have a couple of beers, and we'll knock out the ADR process. It'll be fine.
Exactly. Because one thing that I've learned with regards to the audio process is the ADR process is a delicate, delicate process that you need to handle with fucking care. Because if you don't, oh my God, it's going to be the only thing you can think about. Another key example of this is Samurai Cop. Oh my Lord, the ADR for Samurai Cop and Darkroom, they're atrocious, and that's a center point that you're just watching, like, dialogue come out of a still person's not moving mouth.
Yeah, it's good audio, you don't notice, sounds natural. Bad audio, you're like, holy fuck. And to get how important audio is, like, ask yourself, would you rather watch a gripping story about a man and a woman falling in love, but it's shot on an iPhone from like 2007, but has like natural, you know, good audio that you don't notice that it's bad. You're just like, oh yeah, the audio's there. Or watch a gripping story about a man and a woman falling in love, but it's shot on an IMAX camera, but sounds like it's in a wind tunnel, and then all of a sudden just sounds so muffled. Like, which would you rather, like, spend 90 minutes watching?
I already know my answer. I'd love to have my ears randomly blown out while I'm in my car on my way to work. No, I'm 100% with you. 100% with you. Again, audio and VFX, they are overlooked, unsung heroes of the modern movie scape, because too many times people will go and watch Endgame or something like that, and then go like, okay, cool, and then they just leave, and they go, yeah, it was like Scarlett Johansson was great in that, yeah, she really tore it up, or like, oh my God, you remember the action scene ending when they're like, when Iron Man go, I am Iron Man. But there's nothing relating to, oh my God, the VFX for Josh Brolin. My goodness. Oh, he looks so statuesque. Like, no. Like, they're not. No, there's nothing like that, which is a damn shame.
Mm-hmm. I mean, but speaking of VFX, dude, it's like not just like the big stuff that like we often think about, but it's also the little things like with VFX. Yeah. Like, I remember watching a behind the scenes video on, I think it was The Conjuring. I don't know if it was the first or the second one, but anyways, what they had to do was the film took place like, you know, back in like the 50s, 60s, 70s, around that time, before like security cam, like, you know, before the standard model security cam was a thing, and they had to go through and remove that from certain shots. It's not something you would notice, but like, if you did see that there, you'd be like, wait a second, that doesn't line up with the times. What's going on there? So with VFX, it's a lot of it is what we do not notice. So this actually segues into the VFX, Mike. VFX can date your movie or show its budget. Let's look at The Rock in The Scorpion King, or Spawn for aging.
Or like, that one scene in Buckaroo Banzai when he's flying through the mountain and you see the little goblins in the air.
Oh, I forgot about that one.
that's my VFX disaster.
Or if we're talking about budget, we got Birdemic, Shock and Terror for budget. Or The Sharks in any of the shark movies that we've talked about.
Oh, I hate that there are multiple. But yeah, yeah, no, I agree. I'm absolutely with you, 100%. It's you. Oh my God, I'm trying to just narrow down. Why don't you go ahead? I need to narrow down my thoughts on this.
Look, and by the way, it doesn't just date your movie, because there are plenty of good examples of VFX from older, from quote unquote older movies. Let's just, for instance, look at Jurassic Park. But bad VFX can have the audience thinking, what the fuck is that? Like, for instance, watching Cats or the Claws from X-Men Origins Wolverine.
Oh, yeah.
Or, okay. Or Kangaroo Jack.
Oh, oh my God. I forgot about Kangaroo Jack. Oh, no. Oh, my God. Oh, God. This is like remembering that cringy thing you did in middle school.
Mike, Mike, everyone will never forget the time you shit your pants at lunch.
Mrs. Bukowski said no one noticed. No. All right. All right. Moving away from that thing that totally happened. No, This feels like an easy tee up for the practical effects nerds to beat their chest and go, now this is why practical effects are better. Practical effects are not necessarily better. There are plenty of practical effects that look corny as hell. Like nowadays,
Santa sleigh,
easy as can be. It's an art. Both and are an art.
And Don't Open Till Christmas.
Don't Open Till Christmas is magical with how bad it is. But both of these styles can be dated extraordinarily fast if you are not careful and ginger with your work. There are good examples of practical effects and VFX. Like a great VFX movie is The Matrix. Is The Matrix old? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Is some stuff inevitably dated? Yeah. It still looks pretty freaking solid. Like, if I'm being honest, like, it looks pretty damn solid. Even the T-1000 in Terminator 2 Judgment Day. Like, it's a bit of a cheesy effect, but the turning into goop and all of that, like, that's a solid look. It's much less one's better than the other and more. It's just how much care you put into it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, dude, exactly. I am a supporter of VFX because I've done a little bit of work and I understand how challenging it is. And great VFX are absolutely beautiful. Like, let's just look at like Avatar, Lord of the Rings. I'll even throw the Transformers movies in there. The first one. VFX gets shit on a lot, but when it's done right, it really adds to your movie and can take it to a whole nother level. You get to like do shit in space, or, you know, make fucking Dune. So
yeah, absolutely. I will absolutely admit my bias here. I am a practical effects person. I like my practical effects. I like it when like you're watching Terrifier and you see Art the Clown freaking dig a knife into someone, and you see the blood come out from the blood packet and stuff like that. I think that's a really cool thing, and I definitely prefer that over to VFX. But I'm an absolute dumbass to say that one's better than the other, or that like Dune is worse off because it's using VFX. That's stupid. VFX are great. They really are. Truly are great. You know, Mad Max and Transformers are great examples of VFX versus practical effects. And honestly, Mad Max Fury Road is a great example. And Transformers, actually, are a great example of fusing the two effects. Mm-hmm. Like, I hate Michael Bay, but the motherfucker can fuse the two effects together really well.
And the people behind the scenes that actually, you know, do the nitty gritty and sit in front of like Cinema 4D.
Yes, yes, actually,
or
yeah,
the Maya, whatever program they're using.
Yeah, yeah, the person who actually is doing it, hats off to them. Like, Michael Bay was probably doing coke on a speedboat with like 300 models while that was happening. So,
I mean, sounds like a Friday night to me. So, Mike, I want to now look at each genre. And here's God. And like each movie genre has a series of questions when it comes to them that it presents the audience a promise. Like, and you'll see what I mean here in a second. If these questions aren't answered, it's going to be a lot harder for your audience to enjoy a movie. For instance, action movies. Am I entertained? Is the action good and well executed? Can I tell what's going on? And with comedy, it's real simple. Did I laugh? And again, I understand comedy is subjective and we could dive into the nitty gritty of what makes jokes funny, but we don't have time for that. Drama. Am I invested in whatever our characters are going through? We got sci-fi fantasy. Do I believe in the characters and the world that is being presented to me? Horror. Really simple. Am I scared? Do I feel tense? And then romance. Am I rooting for these characters to be together? And then when these genres fuse together in a unique way, you know, we get presented these questions just kind of twisted a little bit. Mike, what do you think makes each film genre bad? Do you think it's bad if they don't answer those questions?
I think your movie is definitely teed up for failure if it doesn't. Mm-hmm. I think that it's very easily teed up for failure if it does not. Like, I think that for certain genres like comedy and horror, yeah, you bet your fucking ass that's going to be a bad movie. Like, if I walk into a comedy movie and I was like, that was moving. Like, no. Like, what? Like, I didn't come to watch, like if I walked into 21 Jump Street just going like, ooh, I can't wait for silly jokes, and then walked out crying because it was moving. Like, would I think it's a good movie? Yeah, probably. But I wouldn't call it a comedy. Like, I'd be mad. Like, it'd be like, I wasn't laughing. Now, with movies like romance and like action and drama, you get into a bit of a gray area with it. Because drama is, am I invested? I mean, actually, no, I'm going to throw that into horror and comedy as well. I'm going to toss that in, bring sci-fi over to the other side of the court. Mm-hmm. So with sci-fi, romance, and action, you get into sort of a middle ground. Mm-hmm. Where it's like, with a romance, I think the big question of will they, won't they? Or am I rooting for them? I think that you can get around it by having other stuff work alongside it. You can, I feel like you could state your case that like the journey beats the destination with like a romance movie. Mm-hmm. With an action movie, yeah, the action scenes need to be pretty damn good. But if the story is a fun, gripping like thing and you're like, oh, it's a fun romp around the globe. Yeah, why not? Mm-hmm. Why not? Of course. But if you're going to sit there and just like have it be like this sort of drudged out, like fight in one single area, like unless it's The Raid, it's a hard sell, I feel like. And finally with sci-fi, I feel like is one of the harder sci-fi and fantasy. I feel like they're, I feel like they're hard genres to really like nail down as what is a success and what isn't, because they're so sweeping in scale and they cover so much that going like, oh yeah, that was this world interesting? Maybe that might not even like be the case for what makes the movie good or not. And hear me out like on this. Dune 2 changed a lot of people's minds on Dune 1. A lot of people I know, they did like not like Dune 1. They thought Dune 1 was boring. They thought it was a slog with a bunch of characters that they kind of half cared about in this world that they're kind of like, whatever, it's Tatooine, but sandier. Like, and then like Dune 2 comes out and they go, oh, never mind. This is great. Like, it's with movies like that and like Lord of the Rings and all that, I feel like it's, am I invested in everything as well as this world that's being created? I feel like that's the key ticker for me.
Yeah, after hearing you talk about it and thinking about it, I do think like the am I invested, like I said, is like an overall thing.
Mm-hmm.
we can see bad examples. I mean, just go back and watch any number of the podcasts we've done, like go watch United Passions to understand what a bad drama looks like. Oh, I think that's really like the main one that I'm like, what? That's the one question mark that I got with the whole genre thing. But now I want to move on to the, as kind of like our wrapping up point, looking into the realm of so bad it's good. And I want to ask you, Mike, what do you think makes a movie so bad it's good?
Oh my God. I feel like this is the question we ask on the podcast as a whole. So narrowing that down is very difficult. I think that a so bad it's good movie is a movie that has looked at whatever question for it genre, like, let's say drama. Am I invested in the situation that these characters are in? Mm-hmm. And the ants, and they fail that question spectacularly. Not in a like, nope, in a like, oh my God, I mean, no, but what the hell is going on here? Like, how did you? It's like if you're doing a math problem and you get the answer of a half pepperoni, half cheese with a few anchovies on the side. Like that, it's that level of wrong that you that I feel like is what makes a so bad it's good movie.
And I think it needs to be mentioned that a level of honest attempt and seriousness needs to be attached to like the so bad it's good movies. I mean, The Room is a classic example just because how seriously Tommy Wiseau and the people played just this absolutely ridiculous concept. It's hard to go looking to make a so bad it's good movie. In fact, the only one that I can think of is Llamageddon, where you watch it and you can just tell they were going off to make a so bad it's good movie. And I mean, I personally think they succeed. I don't know if Mike's seen Llamageddon, but
Llamageddon's funny. Love Llamageddon. Love Llamageddon.
But 99% of the time, I think that so bad it's good thing has to come naturally. And go ahead, Mike.
No, yeah, I'm right there with you. I'm right there with you. Because I feel like with that lack of knowledge beforehand that you're going to be making a so bad it's good movie, it also lends itself to the creating of camp, which is a key driver of these crappy movies. Like Xanadu, Mommy Dearest, Chopping Mall, Samurai Cop, Zardoz even. Like Zardoz is hilariously crazy, but there's so much camp over the topness that really makes these things just a spectacle of some form, one way or another.
Yeah, and it's got to be in like over the top in terms of like the performances, the visuals, or the script, like Troll 2 with the Oh My God, the robots in Chopping Mall, the mullets in Samurai Cop, or I mean, if we're actually being honest here, the mullet in any movie, the kills in Puppet Master. And I think another thing, like I'm glad you mentioned camp, but another thing I want to mention is, again, getting back to that idea of big ideas but small budgets and just running with it. And like I hear Neil Breen, I haven't seen any of his movies, but I've heard he does a lot of with bad green screen.
Love Neil Breen. Oh my God. Oh, if you want to bless yourself, ladies and gentlemen, go drink in some Neil Breen. Oh my Lord, he is a masterful person in making some so bad it's good movies. It's I 100% agree with you in that the low budget aspect does lend itself for a so bad it's good movie really well, because I feel like with those so bad it's good movies that have that extraordinary low budget, it's definitely that shoot for the moon, land amongst the stars mentality. You can see that with so many of these movies, like The Room, clear freaking thing. Tommy Wiseau refused to shoot on location because, quote, it's real Hollywood movie and shot on green screen. And I'm trying to think. Xanadu, coke-fueled roller skates. I mean, it's so many. Well, actually, no, Xanadu's big budget. I'm trying to think. What's a cheap budget? Oh, Chopping Mall. There you go. Boom, done. Mm-hmm. Fucking full stop. Chopping Mall has no money attached to it. They have metal Wallys walking around, and that's just the fact that you can stare at the things and figure out what they use to put the things together is that's magic. It's magic right there. That is magic.
Well, man, wrapping up this whole idea of what we have learned, I think that, you know, watching bad movies ultimately is, if you are a wannabe filmmaker or just a fan of movies in general and respect the craft and want to learn more, I think you will do it will benefit you to watch some bad movies. Watch a variety of them. Watch the So Bad It's Good, like Chopping Mall or The Room, or just watch some downright atrocious, Bucky Larson, Gotti, Son of the Mask, and then just kind of watch the movies that are just kind of like that forgettably bad. Just go down mm-hmm. the whole spectrum, and with each different movie, you're going to learn something new about why this movie in particular was bad.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. It's, I mean, I know a lot of people, they're going to want to just jump into the So Bad It's Good camp movies, which mm-hmm. again, if you are a casual viewer, do yourself a damn favor. You are not experiencing the raw joy of, holy shit, how did they come up with this? So, but if you're like an honest to God filmmaker or someone who's aspiring to it or someone who just really just gives a shit, seeing those middling movies rather than just like the atrociously bad or the so bad it's good, seeing those movies that are in the middle, that's the sweet spot, I feel. Just being able to look and go, how did this turn into such a wet fart? Is just really, really something.
Dude, and that it is. Well, guys, we're going to be wrapping up this episode, this academic episode of the Messed Up at Midnight podcast. Thank you all so much for tuning in. Go follow us on Instagram, Twitter, YouTube. You guys know the deal. Stay up to date with what we got going on. And Mike, thank you for joining me with this discussion. And do you have anything you want to say?
Watch some garbage, ladies and gentlemen. Come on, it'll do you some good. I swear to God, if you're listening to this podcast at all, watch some slop. Watch some slop tonight.
Watch some crap and learn.
Mm-hmm.
That's it.
Absolutely.
All right, guys, we'll see y'all next week.
See you next week, everybody.